Vincent Namatjira's portrait can be seen as an invitation to examine Australia's colonial past, and Gina's dad's racist comments are emblematic of that history. But no one in the Hancock family has ever really acknowledged them. Gina Rinehart has to this day never disavowed Lang Hancock's racist comments. A Hancock prospecting spokesperson provided the following comment.
Hancock Prospecting and Roy Hill fund initiatives that improve the health and well-being of Indigenous Australians, support essential services in remote and rural areas, and foster participation in employment, sport, education and Indigenous arts. Our commitment cannot be regarded as compliance, as we go far beyond compliance. We invest in meaningful, long-term partnerships that create real opportunities.
Throughout this series, you've heard portions of my conversation with Gina's son, John Langley Hancock. I wanted to know what he thought.
Obviously, Lang made some very racist comments about sterilising the water of Aboriginal people. Is that something you're happy to disavow?
Did he literally think that we should put sterilizer in the water? I don't believe so.
And you agree that had they been meant literally, that they are inexcusable?
Of course. Of course. But I don't believe they were meant literally.
You agree that regardless of if those comments were meant literally or figuratively, they are still inexcusable?
Yes, inexcusable.
And why don't you think Gina came out and publicly disavowed those comments as many asked her to do at the time?
I haven't worked out why. There is also the PR strategy of just saying nothing. I don't believe that was appropriate in this case.
In episode 3, you also heard from one of Lang's close friends, John Singleton.
A great friendship. A really great friendship.
It occurred to me that this was something that was probably discussed between them. And so I asked him about it. And when I did, he ended up telling me something really surprising. Now, I've saved the most difficult question for the last one, John.
Yeah.
Which is, I wanted to ask you about Lang Hancock's comments about sterilising the water of Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk to him about that?
I certainly did. Because Lang was in his flat at Circular Quay when he did that. He did that as a sick throwaway line.
What was your reaction to Lang's comments?
So I found it horrific. And Lang couldn't understand why he was staying at the Circular Quay. I was at Avoca Beach, in a little beach house. And I said, Lang, I can't get down there because I've got kids. I've got 7 kids to look after. But why don't you come up here? Which he did. He drove up, a terrible driver, probably irrelevant. He came to stay with me in a little fibro place on Avoca Beach. And he just was an emotional wreck. Why me? I said, mate, do you know what you've said? Oh, but I didn't mean that in context. Lang, are you kidding, mate? So we went for long walks along the beach. I spent hours talking to him, hours and hours and hours, about some of the things he said that weren't meant to hurt, but how deeply they did hurt. And Lang, well, probably one of the few good things I did for Lang is that I had him be far more tolerant. In the cold light of day, you read that in the headline or on TV news. It's horrible, horrible.
But obviously, in that long walk along the beach,
yes,
you weren't able to change his mind.
Yes, I did. I didn't change.
You did change his mind?
I didn't change his mind. I changed his way of expressing. So I think Lang was foolish in that way. He didn't mean any harm, but it came across terribly, and I told him so. And he did his best to correct it. He failed, by the way. He failed. He failed to be forgiven. That was unforgivable of me, and like most unforgivable things, it wasn't forgiven.
This became an issue more recently when Danelle Wallum, a WA netballer, expressed concern about Lang's comments when Hancock Prospecting was a sponsor of the netball team. And Gina took her sponsorship money and walked away.
Yes.
A lot of people commented at the time that that was a missed opportunity for Gina to disavow Lang's comments and to try and right that wrong.
You're right. But also she had to choose between disavowing her own father.
John Singleton says that from what he can see, the reason Gina has never disavowed Lang's comments goes back to the falling out between father and daughter that happened during the 90s over Lang's relationship with Rose Porteous.
Gina genuinely, totally blames herself. I mean, deep down, how do you forgive yourself for not communicating with your dad, who was your whole life, and vice versa, for the last few years of his life? I know that she's made a decision to honour her dad's memory. And therefore you won't, I don't think you can get Gina to say, at whatever commercial going to Gina, she won't say that Lang was silly or Lang didn't, should have known better. You won't hear those words.
Couldn't she try and make amends?
You're saying, could she have righted the wrong by explaining what I'm explaining? Probably. But Gina also is very shy by nature, very, very shy. She's very in awe of her dad, loves him very much. And she couldn't, I don't think it's in her makeup at all, to see any fault in her father. She went through that period. They reconciled through death. So Gina had to go further in blaming her dad for, I don't think she had dinner. Her dad was back to being a hero. She'd lost those vital years.
It would be difficult for her to disavow those comments now.
She could disavow them. It's never too late. History, it's too late with the existing community. But if it's on the record now, it can help things the next generation or the next. Because this problem's not going away anyway.
There's also a much larger conversation that needs to be had here about Lang Hancock, extending far beyond just these comments that he made in the 80s, because it's not just his words that need to be considered. Long before he was a mining magnate, Lang lived a whole life out there in the Pilbara. He and his family before him had managed enormous pastoral stations. Among them was Mulga Downs, the place of Gina's childhood that you heard about back in episode one. Lang lived there as a young man in the 1920s, and he was there as a station manager in the 1930s and 40s. At a time where working conditions were discriminatory and widespread systemic racist policies were prevalent. The era of Lang Hancock is also the era of the stolen generation, the removal of Indigenous children and of stolen wages.
So he's living on Mulga Downs, managing the station. I think sheep at that time, they had cattle and they had sheep at different times.
This is Stuart Reid. You might recognise him from previous episodes. He interviewed Lang for the National Library of Australia.
You know, you've got to round up sheep and bring them in for shearing, all that sort of stuff. So he's on horseback through all this time. And there are Aboriginal people working on the station and Aboriginal people living on the station as well. And he had very disparaging views about them. Because one of the questions I asked was if he had learned anything from the Aboriginal people. He said, well, you learn what to eat and what not to eat, but other than that, they've got nothing to teach anybody. They know nothing. They've done nothing. They have never built anything. They haven't even built a house. They've never built anything mechanical. So that was kind of his view. And I asked him about ceremony, because ceremony, and he said ceremony was still very much active on the country in those days. And the ceremonies, I asked him about the ceremonies themselves. He said, well, apart from some of them women can attend, some of them women can't attend. He said, but they're all just repetitive. chanting. They've only got about three words, you know, and they just keep going over and over those things. And he did tell the story of, because I asked him also about, this came up in the context of citizens' rights, which he thinks was a disaster. So the granting of citizens' rights to Aboriginal people, in his view, gave them three rights. The right to pay taxes, the right to fornicate with white people, and the right to drink alcohol. And all three had been disastrous for Aboriginal people. That, you know, that's his view, as he put it. And this is a view he said publicly many times, so I'm not, you know, revealing any secrets from this transcript when I talk about that. That's been a view that he's expressed widely.
Did you ask him about those comments?
Yes.
And what did he say about them?
Yeah, well, he repeated them. He didn't resolve from any of it. It has to do, I think, with a mindset about superiority and his feeling that he himself was a superior human being. So it wasn't just a racial thing, but he did see things in terms of a hierarchy of superiority.
How did you feel when Lane died? What was it?
Nothing. Later, at the end of the 90s, I was working as coordinator of the unit, and a woman came into the library, and she wanted to see me as the interviewer. And she said, "I've just read this interview with Lang Hancock, and you sat there and let him say all these outrageous things, these terrible things, and what an awful man he is. And she got really quite hot under the collar about me not challenging him on these things." And I thought, okay, I've done my job here. The true Lang has come out, and it's made someone who dislikes that kind of person really, really angry.
The other very significant thing you need to know about Lang Hancock is that over the years, allegations have been made that during his time at Mulga Downs, Lang fathered multiple children with Aboriginal women who lived or worked at the station before the birth of Gina Rinehart. The first was in 1992 when a woman called Hilda Kickett comes forward in a TV interview. She is born in 1943, 11 years before Gina. Her mother was a cook at the homestead on the station. Then, a few months later, another Indigenous woman also comes forward. A woman called Stella Robinson tells the Perth Sunday Times she was born in 1932 when Lang was only 23, which would make her the first-born Hancock child. She too was conceived at Mulga Downs. Stella goes on to say that Lang's father also had a child with an Aboriginal woman at Mulga Downs and that Lang has a half-sister called Minette Doris. All three women are no longer alive. Did you ever speak to Lang about the reports that he had fathered Aboriginal children?
Yes.
What did he say about it?
Not that I know of. He didn't deny that he had relationships with Aboriginal girls, but he didn't know. I trusted Lang implicitly.
But Lang talked about having relationships with Aboriginal women?
Yes. Good on him. Yes, he did with me.
And there's an incredible power imbalance here, though, as well, right?
Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. But you realise that Lang Hancock was just an unknown white man. He wasn't a multi-billionaire. He was just another bloke living off the bush.
After Lang's death, a Hancock family lawyer said the following, quote, "Everybody who knew Lang and his father was quite adamant it was not Lang's style. That wasn't the kind of thing Lang Hancock would do. I've spoken to young men who worked around Mulga Downs with Lang, and I've spoken to confidants who say nothing like this was ever mentioned or rumoured." Gina Reinhart has never acknowledged any of these women as relatives. We asked her about this, but received no response to that question. No DNA test has ever been performed. During my conversation with Gina's son, John Hancock, I also asked him about the claims. However, he was not willing to go on the record. He has said in the past that, quote, my mother and others who I've spoken with who knew Lang well were of the view that Hilda is not Lang's daughter. It's been reported that in 1997, John approached Hilda at the direction of his mother, asking her to sign a declaration that stated George Hancock and not Lang was her father. Hilda refused. She has been quoted as saying that she would not make a claim for a part of the Hancock estate during her life, saying her life was, quote, far more rewarding than material stuff, and that, why should I? G'day, Kelvin. How are you going? It's Sarah here. I'm glad I tracked you down. I think I contacted quite a few Kickets on Facebook. Hilda Kickett went on to have several children. Her son, Kelvin Kickett, still lives in Western Australia.
Yeah, but Kickett's, that's my dad's side. See, mum was married into the Kickett side.
He has grown up with the understanding that he is Lang's unrecognised grandson and that Gina Reinhart is his aunt. Tell me about your mum.
My nana was working there. That's how it all come together. Nana was a housemaid, and that's when Lang used to go up there. This is what I can piece together. And he used to go up there looking for iron ore and at the station. And my nana was a housemaid there, and that's how mum come about.
Hilda was born in Port Hedland, about a four-hour drive north from Mulga Downs. Afterwards, she was taken to an orphanage in Perth.
Yeah, but she got looked after, see. Old Lang sent mum to a school that she got educated in, a boarding school.
Kelvin claims that Lang made sure she was well taken care of.
So he paid for her schooling?
Yeah. Yeah.
What did she tell you about him?
Well, she knew that he was her father, and apparently there was visits at the boarding school. She you know, there'd be new shoes, there'd be new this and that, what he used to send there. And she, no wonder where it come from, but she knew someone.
Yeah. Hilda Kickett spoke to News Corp in 2012. She talked about her fondest memories with Lang when she spent a week at his home on the Swan River in Perth, playing with her alleged sister, Gina, who was at that time only 2 years old. Hilda was 12. She says, quote, we used to play on the river. He used to flick water. Gina was in this big blessed pram. I used to get her out and put her in the water, just put her to soak.
She tried her best to connect with them, and that's how come she got so sick and tired, because they didn't want to recognise her.
Mm.
She tried her best. She just wanted to be recognised by Gina. It wasn't about the money, it was just recognition. And like growing up without a father you don't know, or you want to find out, don't you?
Yeah, of course. And it obviously saddened her quite a lot.
Yes, most of her life she was, because she couldn't find out who she was.
Hilda attempted to visit Lang on his deathbed, accompanied by the Catholic Archbishop of Perth. She says she was denied the chance to see him.
That's what my mother wanted, recognition and to know who she was and to know who her father was.
And she wanted Gina to acknowledge it too, though, right?
Yeah. Wouldn't you, for a sister, wouldn't you want to, you know? If you had a sister, you want to know. It wasn't my mum's fault as it came about. And Lang had a lot of influence on Aboriginal people, not ladies, men, because he was the boss, you know, of the station, and whatever he said had to go. We was up there months and months, and, you know, old Bungie Mans, and that's how Mum come about, so, yeah.
Sorry, I don't know what old Bungie Man is, sorry.
Bungie Mans, they old white Mans go run around with Aboriginal ladies.
Oh, right, okay, which there was a lot of that happening in Mulga Downs by the looks of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've lived with this secret myself because it was handed down to me, passed on to me by one of his actual daughters, Nanny Hilda. And that memory still blows me away to this day.
I also talked to Devon Kumara.
I'm a Noongar Yamati warrior from the Yuat, Wajak, Amanyu, Badi Maya nations.
He runs the Aboriginal Males Healing Centre near Newman. He's also Hilda Kickett's nephew. So tell me how you found out.
We were staying at Annie Hilda's. Annie Hilda was such a beautiful woman and her husband, God rest their souls. And they were the go-to Aboriginal family that looked after you. Auntie Hilda, there was too much pain for her. But she did share it with you, you know. And she was quite open when you asked. Well, Auntie, is that true that Lang Hancock was into a dad? Yep. I just, when she said it, it was like an epiphany. I don't know if Kelvin showed you a photo of her, but oh my God, she's just a spitting image of yeah. Lang Hancock.
Rose Porteous, Lang's widow, also recognised Hilda Kickett after Lang's death, telling the West Australian that he had told her he was the father. She also spoke about the similarity between Hilda and Lang, saying, quote, "If you put glasses on her, which I did when she came to my home, and I couldn't believe it. I said, sorry, but you are not very pretty because my husband was not a pretty man." The blood that runs in her is the same blood that is in Gina.
But all that family deserves to have a share of that wealth. That's their lawful right because he's their father. He's their grandfather. He's their uncle, whatever the case may be. Even those kids are there of Gina's, they need to be able to be told as well and be informed that this is your family.
During our conversation, Devon imagines a world in which Gina Rinehart embraces her alleged relatives, the many extended family members.
That would be lovely to watch, and a news camera filming it, the sisters meeting their aunties and they're all black. That'd be just too lovely. Oh, you'd be extraordinary for reconciliation. You know, there's legitimate nieces and nephews that's she's auntie too. And she denies that.
It's important to not just look at these claims, which I should stress are untested, in isolation. It's also important to look at their historical context, what was happening at places like Mulga Downs in the 1930s and 40s. It's really almost untold. It's glaringly absent from stories about the foundation of the Hancock family and its wealth. This was a family that was undeniably a colonial force in Western Australia, one of the most notable settler families in the state's northwest. But the story of Mulga Downs, as told by the Hancocks and Gina, rarely, if ever, mentions the predominantly Indigenous workforce that helped keep the station running through much of the 19th and 20th centuries. But it's also, I guess, why this truth-telling is so important, right?
Correct, that's right. At the end of the day, what we give thanks for at the end of the day, we just want some truth to be put out there with that particular person, that woman.
As part of this series, Guardian Australia has uncovered unreported documents obtained through State Archives of WA that shed new light on the relationship between Lang Hancock and one of the children he was alleged to have fathered, Stella Robinson. These documents are concerned with events from the year 1940, when the government, acting in accordance with its policies that created the Stolen Generation, removed Stella and Minette Doris from Mulga Downs. Stella was 6 and Minette was 8. Government correspondence shows that Stella was discovered by government inspectors after pulling over a truck to question some station workers. We've had a voice actor read out a letter written by one of those inspectors.
These men appeared to be somewhat agitated. I noticed that a tarpaulin, which was covered over a portion of the tabletop, was moving. I removed the tarpaulin, thus uncovering two native adult females and the half-caste child, Stella. The girl was placed in the police car. At the time of her removal, her mother was reportedly at Roebourne Hospital. When about 100 yards from the camp, Minette took to the bush, with me in hot pursuit. And after about half a mile run, I eventually caught her and placed her in our car along with Stella.
In a letter that has never before been reported, Lang Hancock writes to the State Minister for the Northwest. He seeks ministerial intervention after the children are taken away. He refers to the children as having been kidnapped and wants them returned. He even suggests swapping them for some other Aboriginal children. Can I read you this letter from Hancock and see what you think?
Sure.
So he says, in the absence of the manager of this station, the local police officer and inspector ran down and captured two half-caste children who were decently clothed and fed and cruelly took them from their mothers to be a burden on the state, despite the fact that they and their parents were fed, clothed and insured by us. No letter of explanation was left or forwarded. 24 miles from us, there are 9 starving, ill-clothed, half-caste and quadroon children of whom both the inspector and the police have been notified, but nothing has been done about them. We would suggest that the two children be returned to us and 2 of the starving mites substituted, as there is no justification for wasting money and inflicting cruelty upon them, especially when every penny should be spent in keeping Hitler from the door.
Yeah, that's so typical of that generation. Yes. It does not surprise me at all. And there are many Aboriginal people out there that have got those types of letters.
So people in the Pilbara know all these stories, right?
Of course they do. Of course they do.
The trove of documents also exposes the racist and protectionist era government concerns about sexual relationships between white men and Aboriginal women. Part of that protectionist era law forbade sexual relations between white and Aboriginal people unless they were married. The documents show that government workers repeatedly discussed conditions at Mulga Downs under Lang Hancock's management, and his suitability to hold a permit to employ Indigenous workers is questioned. They say that the camp, quote, must have been used by white men for the satisfaction of their sexual desires. Lang Hancock is not named in these documents as being under investigation for sexual relations with Aboriginal women. In fact, I'll read you the direct quote. It says, this is in response to Hancock's letter. I'm forced to the opinion that if Hancock considers that the fact of working 2 half-caste native females aged 12 and 9 respectively at the homestead during the day and sending them into the native camp to sleep is fair and proper treatment for these children, well, his sense of fairness is somewhat warped.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
How powerful would it be for Gina Rinehart to come out now and acknowledge the history? I appreciate that it wasn't her and it wasn't, you know, she didn't...
It's her legacy, just like her mining heiress to the mining rights and tenement that he had, that her father had.
It's part of her history.
Yeah. Mm. It's a part of her life. It's who she is.
Mm.
That's what makes her to this day. I mean, the whole thing of, you know, I just can't get over that 40 billion. It's just so sad.
Mm.
One individual could be worth that much, and yet we're dying like dropping off flies in the Pilbara.
Mm.
Literally, Aboriginal people are dropping off flies. And not only that, I mean, there's families out there that have an entitlement through birth to that money.
Mm. There'd be some people who would say, Look, most of this happened before Gina Rinehart was born. Why would it matter if she acknowledged this history now? What difference would it make? Past is the past.
I'll put it to you this way. Why do they remember Anzacs? Yes, we forget. Well, that's the same for Aboriginal people. Lest we forget.
Mm.
Lest we forget. All those things that you just said when you're reading that letter was of a system that dehumanised us. And that dehumanisation is continuing to this day.
And so if she was able to publicly acknowledge this history, what difference could it make?
A huge difference. A massive difference, because we've got a recognition from a well-respected billionaire. So somebody like that coming out and recognising the past and being put on the back foot and responding to it, well, it's just going to show this country what needs to be the truth or the untruth. And they've always made, on our truths, made them out to be untruths. Or they've put it in that context that you have.
Mm.
That's the past. Move on.
Mm.
That's the whole thing. We cannot move on.
Indigenous Australians can call 13YARN on 139276 for information and crisis support. Gina is reported by me, Sarah Martin. The series producer is Joe Koning, and the executive producer is Shelley Hepworth. The head of audio is Miles Martignoni. This episode was also produced by Faza Draki and Jess Hamilton. Additional production was by Karishma Luthria, Isabella Lee, and Camilla Hannon. Sound design in this episode was by Joe Koning.